For 3 years, Muhammad kept a low profile, preaching only to carefully selected people. But, somewhat to his dismay, in 615, Allah instructed him to deliver his message to the whole clan of Hashim. "The task is beyond my strength," he told Ali. But he went ahead and invited 40 elders to a frugal meal. The meagre fare was a message in itself. There was to be no more excessive hospitality. Luxury was not simply a waste of money, but ingratitude, a thankless squandering of Allah's precious bounty. When the elders arrived, they were nonplussed when Ali served them a simple leg of mutton and a cup of milk. When he told the story later, Ali made it sound like Jesus' miracle of the loaves and fishes. Even though there was scarcely enough for one person, everybody ate his fill. After the meal, Muhammad rose to address the gathering, told them about his revelations, and started to expound the principles of his religion of Islam. But Abu Lahab, Abu Talib's half-brother, rudely interrupted him. "He's put a spell on you," he cried, and the meeting broke up in disorder. Muhammad had to invite them back the following day, and this time he managed to finish his presentation. "O sons of Abd al-Muttalib," he ended, "I know of no Arab who has come to his people with a nobler message than mine. God has ordered me to call you to him. So which of you will cooperate with me in this venture as my brother, my executor, and my successor?" There was an awkward silence, and the elders looked at one another in embarrassment. They could all remember Muhammad as a little boy living on the charity of his relatives. How dared he claim to be the prophet of Allah? Even Muhammad's cousin Ja'far and his adopted son Zayd were reluctant to speak. But finally Ali, a gawky 13-year-old, could bear it no longer. "O prophet of God," he cried, "I will be your helper in this matter." Muhammad laid his hand tenderly on the boy's neck. "This is my brother, my executor, and my successor among you," he said. "Hearken to him and obey him." This was too much. The spell was broken, and the elders burst out laughing. "He's ordered you to listen to your son and obey him," they cried derisively to Abu Talib as they stormed out of the house. Undeterred by this humiliating failure, Muhammad continued to preach more widely in the city, but with very little success. Nobody criticized his social message. They knew that the tribal ethos required them to share their wealth with the poorer members of the tribe. It was one thing to be selfish and greedy, but quite another to defend these attitudes. Most people objected to the day of reckoning. This, they argued, was simply an old wives' tale. How could bodies that had rotted away in the earth come to life again? Was Muhammad seriously suggesting that their venerable ancestors would rise from their graves to stand before the Lord of all beings? The Quran replied that nobody could prove that there was no life after death, and that if Allah could create a human being out of a tiny drop of semen, he could easily resurrect a dead body. It also pointed out that the people who poured scorn on the idea of a final reckoning were precisely those who had no intention of changing their oppressive, selfish behaviour. When faced with the insistent questioning of the Quran about the ultimate value of their life, they took refuge in denial and levity. But despite their scepticism, most of the Quraysh were content to leave Muhammad alone. They were businessmen who had little taste for ideological debate, and they knew that a serious internal conflict would be bad for trade. In any case, this little band of slaves, angry young men, and failing merchants was no real threat, and their movement would surely peter out.